Google has been threatening to pull out of China. The move would be a dramatic one since it is a major player in China's search market, and China is poised to become one of the world's most lucrative internet markets. But 2 months ago, Google says Chinese hackers attacked its systems, and Google has announced it no longer wants to comply with Beijing's censorship rules. We called Loretta Chow for the latest. She's a correspondent in Beijing for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi.
Is Google's threat still a threat, which they have been making now for weeks, or are you seeing signs that Google will really take action and remove its search engine from China?
Google's threat is mainly to stop filtering its search engine, which most believe would result in the government taking away their license to operate its website in China. It could still technically have some operations here. I think that's what they are discussing at the moment. And there's no indication they've changed their mind yet, but we'll see.
In Google's case, is this purely, in a sense, a moral stance? That is, we don't want to comply with censorship rules and we have been attacked. Or is this a business calculation? Are they doing well enough to make this very painful?
We do know that Google has long been grappling with this issue. I mean, ever since the day they decided to open their Chinese website. So that's a very real issue for them. To the extent that people say this could be a business decision, they actually, despite not having the same success here as they do in other markets, are, you know, a pretty significant player. They're the second largest search engine in the market by far. The other ones have really minuscule market share. And they also have other investments here, including some really interesting deals with music labels that, you know, don't indicate the types of moves of a company that is trying to pull out of a failing market.
Would, though, China's government be happy to see Google's search engine gone?
It's hard to say what they think, but I think it would be wrong to assume that they're happy to see the biggest foreign player in the market just pick up and leave. Losing Google has been pretty bad publicity for the government, even within China, and the company has tens of millions of users, many who don't want to see it leave. Plus, it's kind of raised the bar for the internet industry here, and analysts think it's really helped other Chinese companies develop.
You know, and what about the other operations in China, not just the search engine? How would Google's other operations be affected if it did indeed pull out its search engine?
If Google stops filtering and is forced to close its search engine, it's still possible they can do research and development here, sell advertising for its international websites, and it also has a number of investments in Chinese companies that are all doing interesting things, which it could theoretically still run.
Theoretically.
Yeah, it's also possible that, you know, the fallout from this, because of the way the bureaucracy works here, that they can have some, you know, interference with their other operations.
And other foreign businesses, how are they responding to this, privately or publicly?
Well, some businesses have kind of spoken out either in support of Google or in support of, you know, the idea that companies should operate within whatever laws of the market they are in. But I think what's interesting about Google's decision is that it really forces other foreign companies to reconsider the way they approach compromising with China for the sake of being in this huge market.
Although, what leverage would foreign businesses have?
Well, exactly what Google's doing now. I mean, these are all projects that kind of benefit China, and for them to pull out and to also have this kind of bad publicity both inside and outside of the country, you know, it does give them some leverage.
Loretta Chow is China correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She spoke to us from her office in Beijing. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Renee.
Now we go to an important story about the way we all communicate. The Federal Communications Commission earlier this week unveiled the National Broadband Plan. It's a 300-plus page document that outlines the agency's blueprint to build speedy and affordable broadband services for all. Here to talk about the plan is Federal Communications Commissioner Michael J. Copps. He's one of five members who helped regulate the telecommunications industry. He's with us now. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you for having me on.
Well, part of the digital divide is that some people have no idea what we're talking about. So if you would just keep it stupid simple for us, what is broadband and why do we need this plan?
Well, broadband is the high-speed connection to the telecommunications infrastructure of the 21st century. We're moving our telecommunications. We're going to be moving a large part of our media, a large part of the way we communicate to broadband. So the need of the hour is to make sure that every American has a connection to that high-speed broadband and has a connection that's affordable for them. Right now, we've got digital gaps in this country. We've got about a third of our people who live in homes without broadband. That translates into something like 93 million folks, and that's one-third of a nation that we cannot afford to leave behind in the competitive country and the competitive world in which we live if we're going to provide jobs and opportunity for all.
Okay, now you've said that access to broadband technology is everybody's right. Why?
Well, I think without it, there's no opportunity. Without it, you don't have the tools that you're going to need to succeed in the 21st century. So if that opportunity, if that access is denied, opportunity is denied. And I think we all have a right to have that. If this is going to be the central platform that we communicate on in every way over and above our personal conversations, then we all have to have access to it.
Now, a number of groups and players have rallied behind this plan. They say it does a great deal to close the digital divide. That's what you and I have just been talking about, the fact that some people have access to this technology now and other people's, a lot of people, not at all. But there are also critics who say that this is really a Band-Aid, that the taxpayers have already paid for this, and it actually doesn't even bring us into line with the technologies that are already available in Japan, for example, or France. For example, according to speedmatters.org, the average U.S. broadband speed is a 20th of the download speed you can get in Hong Kong or Japan or France right now.
One of the large reasons for this is that we've been asleep at the switch in this country for all of these years, when those other countries that you just mentioned have been forging ahead and getting high-speed broadband deployed and getting people to adopt it. We took a very different tack here, where we just thought, well, the private sector will get all of this infrastructure out there, not even considering those areas where there is no attraction for business or the private sector to come in. So we haven't had a strategy, and for the almost 9 years I've been at this commission, I've been saying we're about the only industrial country on the face of the earth that doesn't have a broadband strategy. Let's get a plan. So it was music to my ears when we got a government that was supportive of this, and the president of the Congress instructed the FCC to develop a plan, and that's what we're doing here. And we are playing catch up. You're absolutely right. There's no question about it. But if we do this plan right, we'll not only be playing catch up, we'll be playing going ahead, and that's where we should want your country and my country to be.
The FCC hopes to implement this initiative by the year 2020. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think this is a long process, and the plan is not a roadmap. The plan is a general strategy. The devil is going to be in the details. There are going to be some tough decisions that are going to have to be made, and there may be some mid-course corrections that will have to be made too. But you know, this broadband is the way we ought to see it. This is not just a technology for technology geeks to say whoopee about. This is kind of the great enabler of our time. We've got all of these problems with energy dependence and environmental degradation and lost jobs and lack of health insurance, declining education. There are no solution to any of those problems without a broadband component attached to them. So it goes to just about every great challenge that the country faces right now. And that's why it's so important.
But I guess what I'm trying to get at is what is already being offered in many other countries, a very high-speed broadband under this plan,
will
get to us in 10 years. So won't that leave America already behind?
Well, it's not just going to be nothing happens for 10 years, and then all of a sudden 10 years we get this high-speed broadband. It's a build-out, and it's got benchmarks. So as we proceed, we'll be bringing higher speeds to all the different areas of the country. You got to start somewhere, and it's a long process of building.
What does this mean for our listeners right now?
It means that you really need to be aware of what is going on here. You need to understand the need for adoption. This is not just about deployment and getting the networks built. It's all about making sure that everybody signs up for it. So that means it's got to be affordable, and that means that people have to understand how important it is for their lives. You're looking for a job. Say you're looking with a Fortune 500 company. 75 or 80% of those companies now are recruiting almost solely online. So you don't just put that resume in an envelope and send it off and expect an answer. We're in the digital world now. Things work differently. And that's just one example of many that would cut across every sector of our economic activity.
I understand that one of the reasons you're excited about this is you've been chomping at the bit. You feel that, as we've discussed, that this country is already behind some of our major industrial competitors in advancing this technology. What is the most important thing about this plan, in your view?
Well, you know, there's lots, and I've tried to focus on some of the less tangible aspects of it. If we're going to transition everything to broadband and the internet, that means that's how we're going to get our news and information also. And we all know that some of our traditional media, broadcasts and newspapers, are in a lot of trouble now, but that's still where people continue to get the bulk of their news from. There's just less of it than there used to be. So we've got to figure out how in this new broadband world we're going to support that kind of news and information that folks need. And to me, that's one of the most challenging problems we face. Democracy runs on an informed populace, an informed citizenry, and we've always found ways to make information and news and information available to people, going back to when we had postal subsidies in the first part of our country's life, way back in Washington and Jefferson's time. We've got to find out now how we can make sure that news and information is made available to all of our people in the digital age.
All right.
There is no automatic new model out there for that to happen. We're going to have to work very hard on this to make sure that we have the news and information that we need
okay.
so our country can survive.
All right, we have to leave it there for now. We shall certainly do appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. Michael J. Copps is a commissioner at the Federal Communications Commission, and he joined us by phone from his office. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. Appreciate it.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The music part of the South by Southwest Music and Media Conference is in full swing today in Austin, Texas. Earlier in the week, the tech portion of the festival came to a close. It's called South by Southwest Interactive. Our tech guru and Austin resident Omar Gayaga attended various panels and parties, and he joins us now for some post-festival analysis. Hi, Omar.
Hi, Robert. Good to be here.
And I gather that Twitter, which was almost synonymous with South by Southwest not too long ago, is now just so 2007 at this year's meetings.
I don't know if I'd go that far. I think Twitter is still very, very popular, and it's so integrated into the experience, people don't even talk about it anymore. And the CEO of Twitter was the keynote on Monday. But really, every year now since 2007, when Twitter kind of had its coming out party at the festival, people are asking, you know, what's the next Twitter? What's the next big startup that's going to capture everyone's imagination at South by Southwest Interactive and spread into the mainstream?
And who are the candidates for that honor this year?
Well, this year, the two companies that everyone was talking about at the festival were Foursquare and Austin-based Gowalla. And they do something very similar. These are location-aware applications that allow you to check in at locations and let people know where you are with, say, a GPS-enabled phone. Obviously, there's some privacy concerns with that. Not everybody's going to be comfortable with letting everyone know where they are at a given time. But at a festival like South by Southwest Interactive, you want everybody to know what party you're attending or what panel you're sitting in. And both companies had rival parties going on at the same night. The Foursquare party attracted Ashton Kutcher, but Gowalla kind of had the home team advantage. A lot of people here are definitely rooting for them. Both applications make it into sort of a game. You earn badges. With Foursquare, you can be declared the mayor of a location. So everyone at the festival was having a lot of fun with these. Now, the question is, will it go into the mainstream the way Twitter did in 2007 and 2008? Is this something that will go beyond all the tech geeks that are here in town and that everyone else in the rest of the country will want to adopt and use and check into wherever they're going?
Are these applications that you can turn off? So if you don't want people knowing where you are, you can have privacy?
You only check in when you want to check in at a location. I spoke to some women at the festival who had some safety concerns about it, and they told me that many of them check in on their way out of a location so that people, you know, can't track them down if they've already left. But you can also broadcast what you do on Gowalla or Foursquare to Twitter or Facebook, or you can disable that. So there's a lot of options for only checking in when you want to and only letting people in certain groups know where you are.
Now, the music portion of South by Southwest has overshadowed the interactive part of the conference for years now, but you've been writing about how that may be changing.
Yes, I've been covering the festival for a very long time, and for me, the big news this year is that for the first time, paid interactive registration has surpassed music. We're looking at a growth rate of about 40% over last year's festival and about 12,000 to 13,000 paid attendees at Interactive. Companies like Microsoft, Dig, YouTube, Twitter, they're all choosing South by Southwest Interactive as the place to launch news or to launch new products and to tell people about them.
And some news from Google's YouTube yesterday about independent musicians and their videos. What are they offering?
Well, they have rolled out a service called Musicians Wanted, and what this will be is aimed at indie musicians to upload their videos to YouTube and get a cut not only of the ad revenue, but also a cut whenever that video is embedded on a website. So if, say, a popular music blog picks up a video from an indie musician, they would get a pretty good cut of that ad money, and that would completely cut out the labels as well. So it would be a big win for musicians. Now, this seems to cut right at the heart of MySpace and Facebook and other social media networks that are trying to make a move into music. So we'll be seeing what happens with that. But obviously, if they're going to get a bigger cut, people are going to want to direct their fans to the YouTube video as opposed to, say, MySpace or Facebook or somewhere else where maybe they're not going to get as much revenue from each page view.
Thank you, Omar.
Thanks for having me. We will have links to a lot of the South by Southwest coverage on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
Omar Gayaga is the technology culture reporter for the Austin American-Statesman, and he joins us most Mondays for All Tech Considered. We asked independent musicians, managers, and label owners at the South by Southwest Music Festival for their thoughts on YouTube's new revenue-sharing idea, and here's what they had to say.
My name is Ian Imhoff. I am an artist manager with Northern Alliance Management. Revenue sharing, that's great. I mean, that'll definitely open up a new place for bands to be able to get cash flow from, and it's so hard out there right now for independent bands.
My name's Demeter Yordanov. I'm playing bass for Idiot Pilot. We're from Bellingham, Washington. I'm not sure exactly how it would help with promotion since it's already available to us. There's a new site, Justin TV, that's kind of a live thing that we have fans going to. So I'm not sure if it would help much more.
I'm Mark Ladden. I own Standard Recording Company, based in Indianapolis. Well, it's going to make us probably focus more on multimedia aspects of the music. I mean, if we can generate revenue from video, then we'll be more likely to support videos and, you know, encouraging bands to make videos.
Music industry professionals at South by Southwest talking about YouTube's new Musicians Wanted announcement. The new service will share advertising revenue with independent artists.
The United States Army is overhauling its basic training program for the first time in 30 years. The military says the process of transforming civilians into soldiers needs to keep pace with the new realities of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a new generation of soldiers whose experience with fighting is usually limited to video games. Lieutenant General Mark Hertling is in charge of updating the Army's basic training program. He joins us on the phone from Fort Monroe in Hampton, Virginia. General, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So how has nearly a decade now of U.S. combat in Iraq and Afghanistan informed the military's approach to training?
Well, as a military, we certainly always learn things from combat experiences. But I think particularly during the last 8 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan and in other places as well that maybe don't see as much headlines, we've learned quite a few things about what we were doing right and what we needed to polish in terms of improving our forces. We also have really got a new generation of soldiers, what some may call the millennial generation, who are advanced in terms of their use of technology and maybe not as advanced in their physical capabilities or ability to go into a fight. Mm-hmm. So we're taking that into consideration as well in doing this holistic review of how we do training.
You just used the word holistic.
I did.
I wasn't expecting that from an Army general.
Well,
and that might be what you're talking about.
It is. It is indeed. What we've done, in fact, in part of the basic training review, is changed the amount of hours we deal with what I think the uninitiated would call hand-to-hand combat, but what we call combatives, how to fight. And it's including things like the use of weapons, knives, bayonets, sticks, even the rifle can be used as a weapon without shooting it, and how we use skills like kicking, punching, holds, a combination of martial arts and fighting and just advantaging different moves as we're in close combat situations, which we think we'll be in for a very long time.
Well, do some recruits, when they get to you, they, if I might put it this way, are they marshmallows compared to the the Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg generation?
I think we are seeing a decline across the board in America. And in fact, it concerns many of us in the military, and we're watching it very closely. Mm-hmm. This isn't a decline in our recruits. This is a decline in our American society in terms of their physical capacity. It's just a softer generation. But we can't afford to accept that. I mean, we've got to train soldiers to climb the peaks of Afghanistan or subside in the deserts of the Middle East or anywhere in the world.
General, are recruits these days less inclined to use that old phrase, to salute smartly and charge up the hill when ordered?
I would say we certainly have a generation that is not as disciplined when they enter the military. And some of the things that we are doing, which has always been a part of our profession, are very different than what many of these young men and women are seeing on the block. So whereas they might have what they believe is a form of courage or discipline, it's not what we expect of a soldier in very tense and difficult situations.
So what do you think of this generation of recruits?
I think they're magnificent. And I'm not saying that just because I'm supposed to be politically correct as the guy who's in charge of training all these young men and women. But I got to tell you, Scott, I talk and walk and listen to these young men and women. They're different. They have a technology edge. I think they're smarter than any generation we've ever had before. Mm-hmm. They certainly ask a lot more difficult questions. They team differently. They have loyalty. But I think the most important thing about this generation of millennials, as I said we call it, is the fact that they want to change the world. They want to contribute to something that's bigger than themselves.
Well, General, hoo-ha.
That's very good. You can join up if you'd like.
Well, I didn't sound like I'm tough enough, but thanks very much, Lieutenant General Mark Hertling.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate the interest.
Call it American Idol for Young Inventors. This week in Atlanta, undergrads at Georgia Tech competed for cash prizes as the school honored its most innovative student inventors. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Susanna Capelluto reports.
The audience settles in at a concert hall at Georgia Tech. In the front row, a group of people hold up drumsticks.
Whenever Sarah comes out, we're going to hold them up in there. Go, Sarah!
This is the cheering section for Sarah Vaden, led by her father, Dave. Sarah is one of 8 finalists for the $15,000 Inventor Prize. She invented a drum that changes pitch while you play it. On stage, Sarah has to convince the judges that her drum is something people want.
I actually believe that drums speak louder than words, so I'm going to go ahead and demo and let you guys hear for yourself. One drum, one sound. Let's put some engineering, creativity, and maybe a little pep into it.
Sarah uses a pedal to pump air into the drum while she plays. The event has the feel of an American Idol show, and that's intentional, says Craig Forrest, one of the Georgia Tech faculty members who came up with the idea.
We were trying to think of a clever way to change the culture here on campus so that more students were thinking about starting companies, were thinking about taking a quirky idea from their dorm room or their lab and bringing it out and showing it off in a big nerd fest.
The competition drew 300 entries, ranging from a French press that keeps coffee from turning bitter to a baseball cap that measures brainwaves and can warn drivers when they get drowsy. Some of the inventions were more related to college life.
My name's Matthew Hickey. I study mechanical engineering here at Georgia Tech. My team invented the Koozie Cooler, and it cools a beverage faster than a refrigerator.
10 minutes faster, in fact, and Hickey says it's portable. To win the competition, however, students need more than just a neat product, says Craig Forrest.
Bright and shiny robots are cool, but to win the Inventor Prize, it's got to be a real idea, something that people want, something that people will pay for.
This year's grand prize winner was a product called OmegaWear. It's a shirt with weights in it that athletes can use for strength training. Sarah's drum finished second, and she still got $10,000. Not bad for an undergraduate. Georgia Tech wants to expand this competition to include other universities and foster more creativity among college students nationwide. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capelluto in Atlanta.
I can't breathe for the first time.
This is NPR News.
There's a good chance, as an NPR listener, you've come across a forwarded email from a friend describing a recent report about how NPR's funding is about to be cut off. Usually, it describes Nina Totenberg, our legal affairs correspondent, as the one breaking the bad news. Well, that email, or a version of it, has been circulating on the internet since 1995. And no, it's not true, but don't let that stop you from making a contribution to your local public radio station, please. Anyway, you may have also come across this story that a woman named Barbara Mickelson tells.
Well, I can remember feeling absolutely aghast when a friend had told me how the daughter of another friend had come back from Mexico after meeting some wonderful guy down there, and after spending 2 weeks of wild romance down there, she unwrapped this gift from him on the plane. It was a coffee cup, and looked at it, and it said, "Welcome to the world of AIDS."
Barbara Mickelson used to believe that story. It shocked her. That is, until she started hearing many, many different versions of it. Sometimes it was a coffee mug, sometimes a ceramic coffin, sometimes it was a note scrawled in lipstick on a hotel mirror. She eventually discovered the story was a lie, an urban legend, and that moment changed her life. Barbara Mickelson and her husband David are the mythbusters behind the website Snopes.com. All day long, they scour the internet and sometimes even the bookshelves at real brick-and-mortar libraries, and they look for information. Information to bust myths and rumors that circulate online, like
asparagus, about the idea that asparagus wards off cancer,
or
an upcoming film that will supposedly portray Jesus as gay,
or
a plea to find missing girl named Ashley Flores. That's another favorite. She was never missing.
And every month, about 5 million people visit Snopes.com to find out, for example, whether it's true that Oliver North once warned Al Gore about Osama bin Laden in 1987. It's not. Or if there really was a basketball court inside the peak of the Matterhorn at Disneyland.
There isn't now, but there was a half court way up there that was just sort of used for employee fun time.
All that myth-busting comes out of the Mickelsons' two-bedroom prefab home, perched above a stream, deep in the hills outside Los Angeles, a home they share with 5 cats and 3 rats.
We can see what we sort of heuristically refer to as my office, although it's actually a bedroom for cats in which they have graciously consented to sublet space.
The Mickelsons used to allow their rats to roam free, but they started to chew up the internet cables and phone lines strewn along the floors.
They had to stay in cages after that.
And they seem perfectly fine with that. Aside from the rat cage, the house is packed with cat toys, cables, old magazines, and books. Hundreds of books.
This whole area up here is all of word etymologies and phrases, ideas of where various words came from, when they entered the language, how they've changed.
Every rumor or legend the Mickelsons debunk or confirm is backed by carefully footnoted research. Often they add links to original documents, official transcripts, or video. The story of how Snopes.com got started begins in the early 1990s when Barbara was living in Ottawa, Canada, and David was here in Agoura Hills, California.
Barbara and I actually met online back in the pre-web days. We met on a text-based online discussion group about urban legends. So we, you know, emailed back and forth for a while, and I went and visited her in Ottawa, and afterwards, she came out here to live with me.
And by 1995, Snopes was up and running.
We never had any intent of running what our site has become now. It was intended to be sort of like an encyclopedic reference of urban legends, but we ended up going where the audience led us, which was writing about all kinds of political screeds, scams, hoaxes, missing child alerts, you know, household warnings, and everything else that circulates on the internet.
And it turns out, in many, many cases, the legends they debunk are modern versions of very old stories.
We tell now about a story about a woman who was at a shopping mall and comes back and finds that her car is disabled, it has a flat tire, or perhaps just won't start. And then there's a helpful stranger that seems a little creepy who is offers to help her. And
the man then tries to get in the car with her. She drives off and later discovers a bag he left in her trunk. Inside is duct tape, an axe, and a rope.
There was a precursor to that from the prior to the American Civil War, in which the a suspicious passenger in a stagecoach was basically tricked and gotten out of the stagecoach by the driver so that they could ride off without her, because it was dressed as a woman. And only afterwards they find the carpet bag of the supposed lady. And, of course, it contains a great big revolver.
At Snopes.com, the Mickelsons keep a tally of the 25 hottest urban legends circulating around the Internet at any given time.
Some things are literally around for years and never go away.
Even after you've debunked them.
Yes, they've been in our top 25 list almost constantly for years. It's kind of like the equivalent of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon on the Billboard chart. They're just there for years and they never go away.
Things like warnings about computer viruses or the email that says, if you forward it, Microsoft will send you a free laptop or free cash. Now, while a lot of the rumors the Mickelsons deal with might seem silly or harmless, many they say are not, like the persistent emails that suggest President Obama is a foreign agent bent on undermining America, or a recent photograph circulating on the net in which Michelle Obama poses behind an apple that seems to reflect the image of Karl Marx. Many people actually believe this stuff.
I will confess there are my mornings when I go to Dave and I'd say, why are we doing this website again? Why is everyone so crazy? But I also look at my inbox and see all of the emails that come in from perfectly normal people, from folks who write to say, thanks, I was about to get taken by this scam.
Oh, and one more thing. You know how, despite it all, Mussolini still managed to keep the trains running on time? Well, that's a myth, too. You can read about it at Snopes.com, and you can see a photograph of the Mickelsons at our website, npr.org.